welcome to the Mariners Library with me, Chris Stanmore-Major. In this episode, we're continuing the book The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss by Captain J.C. Voss. We're on the second book of the collection. It's called Sea Queen, and we're on Chapter 1. This is the 22nd part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Sea Queen, Chapter 1. One fine sunny day in the month of October 1911, I was sitting quietly in the cabin of the sealing schooner Chichishima Maru, which was at anchor in Yokohama Harbour after her voyage to the Siberian coast. I was thinking over the law which had just been passed prohibiting sealing and what to take up next, when two young men came on board and, after introducing themselves, said, "Are you the same Captain Voss that made the voyage round the world in the Tilikum?" "Yes," I replied, "I am." From that time I had a good many visitors to the schooner, all more or less interested in my past experiences. Sealing, however, was prohibited for 15 years, so on the 1st of November I left the vessel and took lodgings ashore. In 1911, a treaty was made between the United States, Canada, Japan and Russia to prohibit sealing for 15 years. A sum of money was set aside to compensate all sealers, and as I came from Victoria, British Columbia, to take charge of a Japanese sealing vessel and had sailed out of Yokohama for 3 years, my share of the compensation should have been paid by the Japanese government, but they were very slow about paying out. In the month of June 1912, while I was busy waiting for this money, the two young Yokohama yachtsmen who had first called on me came and inquired if it was quite safe to make a voyage across the ocean in a small vessel. My reply was precisely what it has always been to questions of this kind since I made the cruise in the Zora, that a small vessel is as safe at sea as a large one. At times, when making statements of this kind, people would look askance at me as if to say, "Oh, tell that to somebody else." On such occasions, I put my foot down and retorted, "Yes, and a good deal safer than some of them," a statement which has surely been proved by the crews of the Sea Queen. The two young men who spoke to me about making a long voyage were Messrs. F. Stone and S. A. Vincent, and in the course of that day's conversation, we three agreed to attempt a cruise round the world in the yawl Sea Queen, which was then being built by Mr. Stone and about half finished. The Sea Queen was built on the lines of the Sea Bird, in which Mr. T. F. Day, editor of the Rudder, made his famous voyage from New York to Rome. Her dimensions were: length overall 25 feet 8 inches, waterline 19 feet, breadth 8 feet 3 inches, and draft of 3 feet 6 inches. Sail area 400 square feet. In the beginning of July, the little vessel was launched, and on the 26th we put on board 130 gallons of fresh water, 3 months' provisions, 2 rifles, 1 revolver, and ammunition, 1 Kodak, 1 gramophone, navigation instruments, and our personal effects. The vessel was then ready for sea. All three of the crew being members of the Yokohama Yacht Club, we were honoured with a farewell dinner by the members of that organisation. At 2 o'clock on the afternoon of July 27th, 1912, accompanied by all the boats of the club, we started on our voyage. There was a light wind blowing from the south, and our progress was slow, so the Sea Queen was caught up by a steam launch and taken down Tokyo Bay at a 7-knot clip. When the launch cast off the cable with which it had been towing us, I accidentally let the flag drop overboard while endeavouring to unfasten it, and it drifted away and disappeared from sight. The launch was filled with passengers who had come down to see us off, and we heard one of them say, "Down goes the British flag." Vincent, who was still dressed in his shore-going clothes, said, "Never!" and dived into the sea, coming to the surface after a few moments with our ensign safe and sound. On reaching the yacht, he was loudly cheered by the onlookers. After the launch had given us 3 blasts of her whistle, our friends turned back towards Yokohama, and we, with our wet flag on the mizzenmast, gave 3 dips as a farewell salutation. We then proceeded under all sail towards the south. The light southwesterly breeze took us within about 3 miles from Uraga, which is about 14 miles from Yokohama. All the yachts had been keeping close under the land, where they had a nice offshore breeze and soon came up with us. It was understood that we would anchor that night in Uraga Harbour. On account of the light wind, it was rather late before we dropped anchor. All hands went ashore, and to our great surprise, the crew of the Sea Queen were honoured by the yachtsmen to a geisha dance, which was kept up until the early hours of the morning. It was a most enjoyable night. The following morning, at 8 o'clock, all the yachts set sail, and after wishing us a final farewell, they departed for Yokohama, while we were obliged to remain at anchor to repack our stores. During the last few days, we received numerous gifts from our friends, chiefly in the way of provisions, and the cabin and cockpit were filled with all kinds of things which had to be stowed away before we could get to sea. This repacking and various other minor details kept us busy all day, and it was not until 6 o'clock on the 29th of July that we sailed out of Uraga Harbour. The Little Sea Queen sailed away from Uraga with a light northerly breeze, which increased in force somewhat as we rounded Tsunasaki, the last point of land, after which we directed our course to the eastward and the blue bosom of the great Pacific Ocean appeared before us. The wind was then hauling gradually to the east-northeast, and with a light breeze and quite a large easterly swell, the Sea Queen made slow progress to the southeastward. This, of course, was not according to our wishes, our plan being to sail some 1,000 miles east before going south for the Marshall Islands. However, we had to take the wind as it came, so let our ship go full and by, and after a good meal of soup and fish and tinned meat and stewed fruit, and while enjoying our after-tiffin smoke, we set to work and fixed up our rules and regulations as follows. Number 1. 3 watches of 4 hours each shall be kept, with the exception of from 4 to 8 p.m., when the 4-hour watch is divided in two, these 2-hour watches being known as the dog watches. Number 2. Meal hours to be as follows: breakfast at 7 o'clock, lunch at noon, and dinner at 5:30. Number 3. There is on board the good ship Sea Queen a place for everything, and everything must be kept in its place. Number 4. The man at the helm is responsible for keeping the boat either full and by or on her given course, and is prohibited from falling asleep under pain of a bucket of seawater thrown over his head by the man who catches him. He shall not leave the deck when on duty, but must wait till relieved at the end of his watch. Rules and regulations being duly approved, we sailed to the south eastward full and by, and every now and again passing a Japanese fishing junk. We were now lowering the peaks of the mountains on the horizon, and by the evening we were almost out of sight of land. At daybreak next morning, the Sea Queen and her crew of 3 were well out on the broad expanse of the Pacific Ocean, where mosquitoes, flies and gnats are unknown, and smiling income tax and bill collectors do not pursue the luckless human fleeing from pecuniary embarrassments. The 30th of July opened out with a gentle southeasterly breeze, which remained the same all day. We sighted 2 whales, which appeared to us to be fighting, as they were leaping out of the water together and making a tremendous fuss. The next day, we had a moderate easterly breeze in latitude 35 degrees 44 minutes north, longitude 42 degrees 10 minutes east, with a strong current setting to the northeastward. During the afternoon, the wind hauled more towards the south, enabling us for the first time since we took our departure to lay our course, but later freshened considerably and we were compelled to tie 1 reef in the mainsail. The boat then went along for about 25 hours at a speed averaging 5 knots an hour. The wind lightening early on the morning of the 1st of August, we shook out our reef, but this only proved to be the calm before an approaching storm, as within a few hours the weather became very threatening, commencing to blow hard at about 9 o'clock. The mainsail was immediately reefed, but the weather getting worse, the yacht was laid to under jib and mizzen, when she rode over the large seas in fine style. As the gale showed signs of still increasing, we hove to under a sea anchor. The Sea Queen, under a sea anchor alone, acted in the same way as the Zora and the Tilikum, as without a riding sail she laid sideways to the sea, but no sooner was the little mizzen hoisted and the sheet hauled in flat than the vessel swung head to sea and rode every sea that came along so beautifully that in the cabin one would not have imagined that the vessel was really at sea, so steady was her motion. It was very fascinating to my 2 young shipmates, who had never had a like experience, to watch the way our little vessel rose up on the crests of large seas and then gently sink again into the hollows ready for the next. I expected to see them get seasick for a few days, which of course would have been hard luck on them, but it would have saved the provisions, and a man on a voyage of this kind has to figure out everything. But there was no such luck. They were always ready to do their duty at meal hours, and sometimes between meal hours too. I was soon convinced that my hopes were in vain, and it made me think very seriously as to how I could manage to reduce their appetites by about 2/3. That same night, while the Sea Queen was hove to, our dinner consisted of 4 fried eggs each, 4 large slices of bacon, apples, bread, butter, cheese, tea, and stewed fruit. We passed the evening away smoking, chatting, and listening to our gramophone. We were hove to all night with a full moon and a beautiful evening, but blowing hard. The following morning, the wind moderated and we got underway again under a single-reefed mainsail. That day and part of the next, we experienced fairly good weather, and with a moderate westerly breeze, were making an average of about 4 miles an hour. Toward night, the wind increased rapidly, and by 10 o'clock, it was blowing hard, which compelled us to heave to under reefed sails. The blow, however, did not last very long, and an hour after midnight, we were going along before it again. On August the 5th, the wind hauled into the northeast with increasing force, but as the seas did not appear to be dangerous, we kept the yacht going under small sails to the south till about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, when we had a warning from nature to heave to. A large breaking sea struck the Sea Queen on the port quarter, which almost turned us on our beam ends. Stone and I were on deck at the time, and it was as much as we could do to hang on. Vincent was thrown clear of his bunk against the opposite side of the cabin. A considerable amount of damage was done below in the way of broken crockery and a box of eggs overturned, precipitating its contents into Stone's new helmet, giving one an impression of a saucepan in preparation for frying eggs. This seemed to amuse the crew, with the exception of the worthy owner, who did not appreciate the point of the joke himself. Rifles, ammunition, camera and outfit all got their share of seawater. We then hove to under a sea anchor and riding sail. About a dozen eggs got broken in the helmet. Vincent said that they were too good to be thrown away, and as Stone refused to keep them in his helmet, the broken eggs were transferred to the frying pan and disappeared with our afternoon coffee. At 4 o'clock, I went out into the cockpit to see how the vessel was getting along with the breaking seas, when I noticed that she was still laying head to sea and riding the huge mountains most gracefully. But the speed of her stern drift had increased to about double. Something wrong with the sea anchor, I thought. Looking towards the bow, I noticed that the sea anchor float was still in the same position. I was in the act of going forward to find out if there was still a strain on the rope when I saw a great shark right under the anchor float. It struck at me at once that the big brute had been playing with our drag. "Bring a rifle on deck," I shouted. The beast swam round the boat some 200 yards away. Now and then he would appear on top of a sea and look at us as if to say, "I've done my work, the seas will do the rest, and you three will be my victims." But I think he soon discovered that the crew of the Sea Queen and a rifle were a little too much for him, and he decamped. An hour later it was blowing a heavy gale, accompanied by a large breaking sea, and to show my two friends the effects of oil on breaking seas, I did a little experimenting with different kinds of oil which we carried for the purpose. Our first experiment was with kerosene. Now, kerosene, being very thin, takes quite a lot to do any good, but by using heavy oil, such as fish oil, just a small drop will smooth the top of a large breaker. It is certainly astonishing to see the effect of a small drop of oil on large breaking seas. As soon as the oil strikes the water, it will spread itself over quite a large surface, and as soon as a breaking sea strikes that part, it appears to crawl under the oil and loses its breaking top. As the Sea Queen, like the Tilikum and Zora, weathered all seas without the aid of oil, we saved it for some future occasion. Vincent, after being knocked off his perch several times, managed to get some photographs of the breaking seas. The boat was drifting astern at an unusually fast rate, but as she lay very comfortable, we let her drift for the night. The next morning, we noticed for the first time that our yacht had sprung a leak. During the forenoon, the gale moderated, and hauling the sea anchor aboard, we found it very much torn. This no doubt was what caused the fast drift the previous night. The damage had undoubtedly been done by the shark. The wind moderated, and as it kept in the northeast, we let her go to the southeast. The leak became worse, and it being dead against my principles to go on a long voyage with a leaky boat, whether large or small, I proposed to put back to the Japanese coast to overhaul her. My two mates were very much against my proposition and offered to bail night and day if I would only keep on going to the east. So I consented, provided matters got no worse. However, the leak increased from time to time, and I was afraid that the weight of the keel was too heavy for the boat and was gradually loosening the fastenings in the frames. We had then about 2,000 miles to cover before sighting the nearest island of the Marshall Group, and only about 500 miles to the Japanese coast. I therefore again made the proposition to turn back, and after explaining the danger of proceeding in a leaky boat on a long ocean voyage, my friends both agreed to my suggestion. We then declared to make for the Bonin Islands. On August the 6th, the wind hauled into the southeast. The weather clearing, and for the first time in 3 days, we had a look at the sun and got our position, finding the vessel in latitude 37 degrees 53 minutes north and longitude 51 degrees 45 minutes east. The northeasterly current had carried us 120 miles more to the north than I had expected, and owing to our leak increasing, we altered our course for Aikawa, a whaling station near Sendai, which, according to my reckoning, was about 500 miles distant. Never before in my life had I been obliged to turn back with a leaky vessel, and I therefore felt bad about our luck. To make matters worse, it was my birthday. I was 54 years of age, but it had to be done. We shaped our course to the westward, and with a fresh southeasterly wind, the leaky Sea Queen, under all sail, stood in for the land. On the morning of August the 7th, the wind increased to a moderate gale, and once again we were obliged to reef the mainsail. At 3 o'clock the following morning, while the boat was going it pretty strong, a small sea came over the stern, which I took to be a warning from nature to shorten sail. After that we took in the mizzen sail and kept running before a strong easterly wind and quite a large sea under the staysail only. The boat went along that way very comfortably till on the morning of August the 8th things got a little too wet round the cockpit, so we hove to under a reefed mizzen and storm staysail with the sheet to windward. In that condition, in spite of the strong wind and large seas, she lay very comfortably. At 10 o'clock the wind moderated, and at noon the little vessel, under all sail, went along again towards the coast of Japan like a scared dog. The afternoon turned out beautiful. From the day we left the Japanese coast, we had experienced nothing but bad, rainy weather, so the change in the elements was very welcome. The night was fine too, and it was really a pleasant change to find oneself lying peacefully in one's bunk without the howling of the wind and the noise of the breaking seas, and the little Sea Queen sailing peacefully along with a light breeze and smooth water. After our evening meal, owing to the beauty of the night, we all three sat in the cockpit talking over our experiences since we had left Japan and about our misfortune in having sprung a leak. At 9 o'clock, Vincent and I turned in, leaving the mate to keep watch till midnight, after which it was Vincent's turn till 4 o'clock the following morning. When I went below, I said, "Now look here, I'm going to have a good sleep, so don't you people start shouting again. All hands on deck, shorten sails." I'd hardly touched the bunk when I was off to sleep, and I slumbered till I heard those familiar words which I had spoken so often myself during the last 10 days. "Reef the mainsail!" But this time it was Stone who spoke just before his watch finished. In a second, I was on deck. There was the Sea Queen going along like a racehorse with her lee rail under water. We put one reef in the mainsail and took the mizzen in, after which the yacht went along quite comfortably. At midnight, Vincent took the rudder and Stone and I turned in. I then slept soundly till I heard Vincent's gentle voice coming down the companionway. "Down below there, Captain. It is 4 o'clock. Your watch on deck." "All right," I said. "How is the weather?" "Fine," came the answer. I then went on deck, and sure enough, the wind had moderated, and the sky was clear. After setting all sail again, I took the rudder, and Vincent lit the stove to make a cup of coffee. Within half an hour, the coffee was ready, and as the morning was so beautiful, we all three had our coffee in the cockpit. At about 9 o'clock, we sighted smoke to the northeastward, and by looking through our glasses we could see two masts and the top of a smokestack rising gradually out of the water. It was apparently a large steamer steering to the southwest, and an hour later, when the steamer was about a mile and a half ahead of us, she turned and stood towards us, and coming alongside proved to be the Japanese steamship Chicago Maru from Seattle, bound for Yokohama. "What are you people doing round here in that boat? Have you been blown away from the land? Are you lost?" the Japanese captain shouted. "Come alongside and I will hoist you on my davits and you can go with me to Yokohama." We thanked the captain for the trouble he had taken for us and for his kind offer to take us on board, and after a short explanation of our doings, the captain gave us his longitude and we parted the best of friends. In less than an hour, the steamer was out of sight and we were left to ourselves again. At about noon, we got amongst a lot of fish. In fact, the water was just alive with them. Hurrying through tiffin, we got our fishing gear on deck. My two mates were well satisfied that I should take the rudder while they did the fishing, and so was I, because I knew from former experience that fish in that part of the ocean were very hard to get. While they were almost breaking their necks to catch a fish, I told them that I would eat raw all the fish that they caught during the day. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, a school of porpoises came gambling along, and both fishermen made a dive down into the cabin for rifles. In less than a minute, they were standing on deck with loaded rifles waiting for the porpoises to come near our boat. No sooner were they within range than my mates opened fire, and one of the poor big fish turned belly upwards. "Tack ship! Ware ship! Put her round! Quick, hurry up! He's sinking!" I received about a dozen orders in 1 second, and getting so rattled with all the orders, I got the boat between two winds. At least I could not do anything with her to get near the fish. "Hoist the mainsail," Vinny said. "Hurry up. If we lose that fish, there'll be trouble in the family." "The mainsail is up. What are you talking about?" I asked. However, after all kinds of shouting and manoeuvring, we got alongside the dead fish. "What are you going to do with it?" I queried. "You can't get that fish on board. It weighs about 500 pounds. "If the weight is 1,000 pounds, he has to come on board," Vincent replied. The mainsail was then lowered, and by hooking the main throat halyard onto the tail of the fish, we gradually managed to get the monster on board. Having the fish laying across the foredeck, the weight of the same almost putting the bow of our little vessel under water, Vincent looked at me and said, "I heard you say that you are a man of your word." "Every time," I replied. "Eat that fish raw, then." "Eat what?" I asked indignantly. "I'm afraid you'll have to excuse me this time, Mr. Vincent, because you will doubtless remember that a porpoise is not a fish, but is classified by zoologists as a mammal." Thus I managed to escape the penalty for a hasty assertion. However, the incident served as a lesson to me, and I made up my mind to refrain in the future from rash promises. The weather continued fine, and on Saturday, the 10th of August, at 4:30 in the afternoon, we sighted land. However, the wind died out and we were becalmed until the following morning, when a light breeze came up from the southeast, and at 11 o'clock we dropped anchor in the snug little harbour of Aikawa, a whaling station situated on the mainland and about 4 miles west of Kinkasan Island. Aikawa is only a small place and there is no accommodation for repairing vessels, but with the assistance of Mr. Kurogani, the manager of a whaling company, we got the Sea Queen out on the beach and found the cause of the leak was bad corking. Otherwise, the vessel was in first-class condition. We had her recorked, and after putting her in the water again, she was tight as a bottle. During our stay at Aikawa, we made a trip on a small coasting steamer to Kinkasan Island. This island is a resort for pilgrims, being dedicated to religious purposes. Deer are numerous there and are considered sacred. On our arrival, the steamer was anchored about 100 yards from the west coast of the island, where we landed with difficulty owing to heavy surf breakers. After following a trail which led towards the summit of the island, we came to a large Japanese temple, where we were invited by one of the priests to inspect the great temple, where the Emperor of Japan, I was told, visits once a year for the purpose of worshipping. Entering the temple, we were shown into a large Japanese room and treated to Japanese tea and fancy cake. "How kind this old priest is," I thought, but my opinion of the old gentleman changed when he told us that it was the custom amongst foreigners visiting the island to give about 100 yen towards the upkeep of the temple. "Pretty expensive afternoon for distressed sailors," Stone said. "I think so too," I replied. "I haven't even got 100 yen in my pocket." However, after we explained our circumstances, he was satisfied by our paying for the tea and cake only. The island is covered with different kinds of large and small trees and splendid grazing lands for the deer, which can be seen in herds all over the island, and are as tame as sheep. On the east side of the island stands a lighthouse, which shows a fixed bright light and can be seen at a distance of 19 miles. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next installment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you are safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.